Subaltern Podcast with Nikesh Shukla. Download for free off iTunes and thesubaltern.tumblr.com. Follow Nikesh on Twitter at Nikesh Shukla. The Subaltern Podcast.
Mi familia, welcome to episode 54 of the Subaltern Podcast. I am your host, Nikesh Shukla. That beginning was a sort of half Sulu and half 70s game show host, I guess. Welcome to episode 54 of the Subaltern Podcast. Things are gearing up. I am finding myself in the busiest time of my life. Mayfest starts, which is a citywide theatre festival in Bristol, and I am artist in residence in Mayfest from the 15th to the 25th of May, Showcase in Contemporary Theatre. I am writing a show for the 2015 Mayfest, and so I have to spend a lot of 2014 going to the shows, learning how to write theatre. Never written theatre before, should probably learn. So that's what I'm doing. Also, on the 25th of May, I am showing, staging a live reading of The Time Machine, my food novella, with live cooking on stage. We're going to be recreating my mum's kitchen on stage. That'll be me and Chimene Suleiman and my Nishakaki and my Kiran Mami. And then June becomes the month before my second novel, Meat Space, comes out. And bloody hell, I am shitting the bed on that one. You know how authors are told, oh yeah, just be on Twitter, promote your stuff on Twitter. Well, you know, promoting your own stuff takes a lot longer than just doing a few tweets. And you know, putting stuff together, putting together a thoughtful digital campaign takes a lot more than just doing a few tweets or retweeting some nice reviews from some bloggers. You end up doing some weird old shit. A month ago, I found myself on South Bank Centre dancing about while a hidden camera filmed me. I found myself adding meat sunglasses to various celebrity chefs' faces. All manner of stupid shit. And it takes you so far away from actually writing a novel that part of you wonders, why am I doing this? But part of you also hopes that the sort of the slightly irreverent and ephemeral is the stuff that makes people take notice of this thing that you spent 4 years pouring your heart and soul into, and not like some review in the FT or whatever. I don't really feel like I'm an FT review, Guardian review, Times review kind of guy. I mean, those would be nice, but I just don't feel like if I was to get those, that's really where my peoples would be reading it and going, yes fam, I'll be picking up Meat Space. So that's why I spend a lot of time on Photoshop with Greg Wallace's beautifully round face, adding some meat sunglasses to them. I don't know what the lesson here is. I think the lesson is probably writing ain't just writing anymore. And if you're one of those ponces who thinks that writing is just writing a book, well, more fool you. See you at the release date. I don't know, that sort of fizzled out. Anyway, so yeah, because I'm so busy, man, sorry about these podcasts and the regularity and whatnot, and also sorry that they're going to end soon. I'm going to be ending the podcast in September. Half a financial reason, it costs me money to host these, it costs me money to edit the, to record these, it costs me money to set these up. partly time. It takes me a long time to edit them. I don't do that much editing, but, you know, I have to play about with the sound, especially if I'm going to be recording things over Skype or in ambient places like cafes. It takes me time. I'm not a dedicated sound engineer, you know? So yeah, for those reasons, it's time to say goodbye to the podcast. I reckon I've got 10 more episodes in me yet. 10 more sterling episodes. I mean, today we've got Jenny O'Phil, who is wonderful, really, really sweet and lovely and funny and brilliant. And I don't know, reading her book, I thought she was going to be a lot more serious than she was, but she's not at all, which is a compliment. I thought she was very wonderful and very sweet. Next week, we've got Akhil Sharma, who wrote my favourite book of the year. The episode after that will be Rana Dasgupta. I recorded that like 2 months ago. I just want to get, basically I'm doing Jenny and Akhil back to back because those are the two best books I've read all year, so I want to get you guys buying them, support those books. So yeah, this is my interview with Jenny O'Phil. Take care.
Bye-bye. We'll just go for it. So Jenny, is it Jenny O'Phil? Jenny, how do you pronounce
it? The word off and the word ill, O'Phil.
O'Phil, and where does that come from?
It's Welsh, actually.
Oh, Welsh. Yeah. Where
I think it was originally of the field or something. It got mangled over the years.
And do you have this? Can you trace back your Welsh ancestry, or does it go further back than you've been able to work out?
I think about 4 generations back. I'm definitely nothing but Scottish, English, and Welsh. I don't have any non-UK parts to my background. Oh. So.
Well, okay, let's talk about things. Where do you get your ideas from, Jenny?
I get them from tabloid magazines.
What's your favourite tabloid magazine of choice? Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
And which Kardashian do you follow the trials and tribulations of?
No, I don't read. I don't like the celebrity ones. I would like the weird world news ones, which are about, like, you know, plagues of frogs or someone coming down in a spaceship. Nothing too exciting about celebrity people, I don't think.
There seems to be a lot of philandering aliens around. Because they seem to just be knocking people up all over the world, and yet only these magazines care about this quite sinister thing that is happening.
Oh, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like, must be their Darwinian imperative that they have to come down here, quickly make contact with.
Yeah, it's sort of this weird, what you assume is a primal human urge rather than a primal universal urge, that the first thing that any alien would want to do would be to rot with the thing that it comes across.
They're on vacation, you know, they're just trying to get laid.
Yeah. It's their version of spring break, maybe. I don't know. I'm quite a big fan of, in those sort of tabloidy newspapers, I love the headlines. The headlines are always really, really brilliant. There's a really horrible, sexist, racist newspaper here called The Sun that does amazing headlines. And one of my favourites was there was a news story about 10 years ago that Frank Sinatra had been having lamb's blood injected under his skin to give him a more youthful look, and the headline was "I've got you EWE under my skin," and since then I've been obsessed with those sorts of headlines. There was no question there. It was just me telling you a random fact about myself. So whereabouts are you based in the States?
I'm in upstate New York, about an hour and a half from city.
Buffalo, like around there? Is that
not that far up? It's not that hardcore winter, but it's up by some colleges up here. It's up by Bard College, and it's a little bit. It's definitely a bit colder than New York. I mean, we still had snow on the ground until yesterday, so it can be a little rugged. I'm a pretty indoorsy person, so when I sort of like just have to hunker down and get through the winter. But it's good for getting writing done.
Are you teaching up there at the moment?
I'm not teaching up here. I teach in the city. I'm sort of the roving adjunct. I don't know if you guys have that same setup over there, but
you're one of those famous big name authors that swan in and do a lecture a year and then swan out again, and everyone swoons.
Underpaid worker who comes in when they can't get a big shot. That's more the setup.
How do you find teaching? When you're teaching, is it with students who are aware of your work as a writer? Do you feel like that sort of may change the dynamic of how they receive your teachings, or is it genuine with students who aren't that well read and therefore haven't come across your work before?
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I took a writing class, I would always read whoever was teaching the class, partly just because I wanted to know if I should take their advice or if I thought they were a good writer or not. But my students, they never seem to read anything I write until a little while afterwards. And they say, cause they don't want to be influenced or try to write with you. But I think they're just lazy. They might read me more now.
or they wait till they get a bad mark and then they go, but I'm going to read her and see how good she actually is.
I'll write a mean Amazon review about her.
Yeah. Yeah. I did an interview with Juno Diaz a couple of years ago for this podcast. I'm not just name dropping or anything, but he insisted that his students didn't really know that he was a writer, which I thought was astounding. That you would go and do a creative writing take creative writing classes at MIT and not know who Juno Diaz was. Like, people, I would have thought that people would on purpose apply to do creative writing there because he taught there. So I don't know if he was just bullshitting me or not, but I was astounded.
The only thing is that MIT is such an engineering and math and science school that it's possible he can fly a little under the radar. But I mean, he's one of the most famous writers in America, or probably in the world. So it's hard to believe there's not a few people in there who are kind of, you know, fanboying it as they wait for his comments.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So with the new book, how is it now you're not thinking about it? You know, it being quite a short book, did it have a short shelf life in your head, or while you're writing it and editing it, or because it's very concise, did it take a lot longer to get right?
I'd say the latter. I mean, I just take a long time with books. Always. My first one took me 10 years. This one took me 10 years.
But that's okay, isn't it?
Yeah. It makes other people feel sorry for me, but it's just the way I write. longer I work on a book, the shorter it gets. I don't know what's going on there. But the main reason that this one's still in my head is just that I'm talking about it so much. I feel like, you must find this too as a writer, that you probably don't think so much about everything about your book and how you constructed it and everything until you go out and you're talking about it. So I'm trying to write my new novel, but I do feel like I'm still kind of in the world of this book.
I sometimes feel like you, like I retrofit a reason for certain things being the way they are. But certainly, once I've finished it, and maybe it's instinctive at the time, but at the time I'm more focused on sort of big picture stuff. I mean, the novel that I've just finished that's coming out in a couple of months, it's essentially a book about technology filled with dick jokes. But I've come up with this whole theory that it's about the difference between, you know, human interactions being very, very flesh-based and human interactions online being very, very pixelated. And I'm just bullshitting my way through coming up with a PR, like a quotable. And it almost feels like the quotable has superseded our need to just write a book and get on with the business of writing. Now we're brand advocates for our own work as well as the producers of our work.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the whole branding talk just always kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. I mean, I know that's the way the world the world is these days, but it does seem like, I mean, I'm happy to talk. I think it's kind of interesting to talk about how you end up structuring a book or about specific passages or things like that. But, you know, every once in a while you get one of those interviews where someone's asking you kind of, what does this mean? What's the hidden meaning of this? As if you've like constructed this whole secret, you know, level of symbolism that the English majors are supposed to find. And I never really have any answers for that. For that, I will just totally make it up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always interesting to see what people project from their own lives onto your work.
Definitely.
As well. It just occurred to me that in the 10 years between your last book and this book, you know, the writing life, I'm doing air quotes, listeners, the writing life is sort of must seem unrecognizable from how it was the first time round, do you think?
That's terrifying. It's like, I just kind of like popped my head up and I was like, oh fuck, what's going on?
You know, sitting down with people and them going, hey, will you go on twitter.com? And
right.
Will you write blogs?
I did a kind of characteristically like shoot yourself in the foot thing, which is that I went on Twitter for about 6 months, about a year and a half ago. And I thought it was really fun. I really liked it. I was kind of amazingly impressed at how serious the book geekery is on Twitter. I was happy because I never liked Facebook or anything, but I was just like a little rat with like a lever, like, oh, please, may I have another pellet of interest and praise and please, you know, it's like, oh man, it made me so squirrely. I had to quit it. And then I quit it about a month before my book came out. I just didn't tell anybody because I thought I would get in trouble. It just means I have to send a lot more individual emails if I'm trying to make someone come to a reading. But my dad is a big kind of crazed Twitter person, likes to tweet about the Democrats in a positive way.
Oh,
but he tells me that he'll say like, oh, somebody's talking about you on Twitter. If somebody says something nice, or if it's really bad, he'll get kind of upset. He basically sees it as like a sports team, almost like someone's team against Jenny or for Jenny. So you're, you know, if I'm on your cast and you say anything about Twitter, he'll be happy. He'll probably be like, you know, whatever you do on Twitter.
That's quite sweet. I think almost like your dad is doing your vanity searches for you, sort of saving you the trouble of looking up your own name and you know, checking your Goodreads reading, your rating.
I do feel like there's just a lot more ways to drive yourself crazy than there used to be. I can remember that you would just get your reviews Xeroxed by some assistant at the publishing house and you'd receive them a couple months after it happened. I mean, you might have heard about this one or that one or seen it. But you certainly hadn't been looking at everything. And what's really kind of charming is that people still seem to do that at publishing houses. Every once in a while, I'm just sort of like, you know, there's a thing called like a Google alert, you know, we just found this review.
Hey, person who keeps telling me I should be on Twitter. Have you heard of a thing called Google alerts? Have you heard of PDFs? Saves a lot of paper.
I know, but imagine
somewhere, you know, they probably have to keep the cycle of work experience moving. You know, all these kids come to the big city and they want to work in publishing. What are they going to do? Well, we can't trust them with an actual campaign. Well, let's get them photocopying coverage.
That must be what it is. Because I was always like, what? Cause I especially wonder when I get them in the mail now. I'm like, wow, somebody is like doing their time at the Xerox machine. So it's funny. But I do feel like you know, some people are just very good on all those social media things, but I feel like to me, I just felt like I didn't have enough restraint to like stay off it. If I was going to go on it, I would just be like sucked in. And I also feel like there was like only two modes. Like I always felt like I sounded like too earnest or too snarky. Like one or the other. Like I always felt like I was just like, hey guys, read poetry, or else I was like, yeah, fuck you, blah blah blah. You know, there's like nothing kind of like with that little in between mode. I think the people that can manage that are always the best.
I long for the ability to use Twitter like a news service, because essentially you're subscribing to the feeds of people who will lead you into rabbit holes that you've opted into. Well, I will click on this article and I will click on this video, and you know it's been curated because I've chosen for these people to do things, but for these people to pop up in my timeline. But what then happens is the compulsion to comment takes over, like that almost overriding human need to have an opinion before you actually engage and absorb in something takes over, which is crazy, because I long for just, I wish I could just scroll through and go, oh, Tedric Cole's posted an interesting article from The Atlantic, I shall read that for half an hour, and that's my half an hour of Twitter done, because I've gotten something really, really interesting out of it.
Maybe someone should make it so that you can just disable the commenting. Like, you know how they have those things like self-control and freedom? Maybe they should make it so that you can't let anybody know you read it, so that you have like some kind of purity bubble around your reading.
Yeah, exactly.
There's all these things now where they're people are starting to track if people have really read the things that they're retweeting or I know NPR did a thing here for April Fools where it was saying that, you know, if you've actually read this, it said like people don't read, and then all these people started tweeting these angry things about it, but if you actually went to it, it said that it was an April Fool's joke.
So when you're in conversation and people project their own lives onto their reading of your book, it's interesting talking about all this stuff with you about the internet warping our minds, because the way Department of Speculation is written, for me, the delicate fragments feel like you almost like scrolling through a blog, or do you know what I mean? Scrolling through someone's life at a really fast pace, or like reading their timeline on Facebook. So it felt quite prescient for me. Does that make sense? I'm probably just projecting something onto it that I'm interested in, rather than
prescient. I've never been called prescient about anything, so I'll take it. I think it was more a matter of you know, I was trying to catch a certain quality of thought, and of the narrators are really kind of, her thoughts are very jittery and they circle back around a lot, and I felt like I wanted her constantly to have, when she's thinking, I wanted her to be interrupted by some kind of action that she had to do in her daily life. And when she was in her daily life, I wanted her to be sort of interrupted by some thought that she was having. And so that kind of cross-cutting came from that. But I think it does echo what you're talking about.
Yeah, which is your way of doing that thing that you said you do.
Well, it's funny because I was thinking to myself as you went off, oh no, I've backed myself into a corner, because I basically said that anything that I have to say about my book, I'm just making up out of whole cloth.
I read the Department of Speculation as an allegory for the second Bush administration. What do you think about that?
It's really more about the Ford administration, but you're not the first to make that. Deeply political novel.
Deeply political novel. How much of it was rewriting?
Well, it's funny. It took me a long time to find the form that I wanted for it, especially the way that the point of view changes. So once I had that, I kind of went back to all these little fragments I had, and I started to understand that whenever the narrator is close to the person she's talking to, then the point of view is going to be really close, and then it's going to become really distant as she spirals away. And once I got that, then I just went back and kind of did it sentence by sentence. I'm not one of those people who can write a big baggy thing and then go back and fix it. I have to kind of do it line by line, which is a terrible, terrible way to write. But at least it means when you're done, you're kind of, there's not that much revision.
And I guess with that comes a degree of not being too precious about it, getting it right the first time.
Mm. Well, I think I'm horribly precious about getting it right. I mean, I think that that what I mean is that I'll have all these sentences or these little paragraphs that are that I've just worked on and tried to make kind of feel like they hold steady to me. And then, but the form of how they all fit together made no sense to me. In fact, it seemed like it was just a total delusion that they were ever going to go together. And then at a certain point, I started to see that picture of how it went together. And then I just went back from the beginning and I put them together. But there was what I cut back from the book was all the facts. There was like a million different, like, oddball facts. And that's what I have, like, extra stuff of. Not so much. I'm like a Depression era writer. Like, everything I write, I keep, because I don't write very much.
What kinds of facts? Like,
well, I mean, there's lots of, like, B-list trivia about Buddhism and evolutionary biology, and lots more about cosmonauts. And what did I find the other day? I found something where I'd written down what various smoke signals meant. I don't know where I was going to use that. One puff of smoke means attention. Two means all is well. Three means send help. So, you know, if you need that, there you go. That's your one bit of useful information from the day.
Yeah,
but yeah, so that's what I cut back mostly. But, you know, I did have this idea when I was writing it, an actual idea, not a after the fact idea, that I realized a lot of the books I like are kind of, they're kind of philosophical idea of books of ideas, and that someone's just wandering around thinking. And yet most of them don't have women as their narrators. You know, mostly they're about, like, trying to quit smoking, or something like Confessions of Zeno, or Out of Sheer Rage, which is that Jeff Dyer book I like. It's about, like, what books to pack on your vacation. And I just never read one where there was someone in it who was also, like, a wife and a mother. And I thought it would be interesting to have a character that was, you know, that solipsistic, but was also, you know, had more to think about than just what book to take at the given time.
Yeah. And it's the way that the narrative perspective changes, is that were you worried at any point that people wouldn't sort of get on board with it, like they would find it too jarring, or were you sort of quite confident that it makes sense internally, so it should make sense?
It was more, I was worried about it. I mean, I worried about pretty much every aspect of it, about if people would get it or if it would make sense at all. But with the part about the point of view, I teach writing, and so I kept having these moments where I was like, why am I writing this in the second person? Like, why have I got to fix this? So why is this in the third person? And I kept sort of, for a while, I kept trying to make it consistent. And I just did have that moment where I realized that the authorial distance at any point just exactly equaled how distant she felt from her husband. And when I figured out that, it made sense to me that when everything's fallen apart, she spins out and she speaks of them as the wife and the husband. And earlier on, she addresses him as a you. I've been pleasantly surprised that people weren't freaked out by the changes of that. A friend of mine who's an artist says, oh, writers always think that's such a big deal, and no one even notices, no one even cares. So maybe it was just one of those weird concerns you have when you're writing something. But I also felt like it was fun. I like it when I can figure out a way to kind of experiment with structure that also feels, you know, not just a cleverness, but it felt like emotionally needed.
Yeah, it kind of, for me, kind of reads like an increasingly louder cry for help. Do you know what I mean? Like, the way it sort of, it's anyway, I'm not going to tell you what, like, I'm not going to pretend to, like, project my own stuff onto the book. I'm more interested in how you put it together, almost on, like, a practical level. So you know you weave in lots of different quotes from places. Were they things that you kind of had stored up and you knew that you were going to use them, or, you know, was it a case of going out and finding these things to slot in? And also, when, because for me, like, because the writing is very minimalist, there's a lot about the rhythm that almost feels very poetic. So it's flipping between your own rhythms and your own poetic syntax within the prose. Does it to a quote in someone else's words. How did you find integrating that into the text?
Well, I felt like I didn't go out sort of to find them. I mostly kind of had collected them with no idea where they were going to go or how I was going to use them or just when I was reading. But then it was more like I would have a feel in this book for something like I'd almost like want a particular like emotional tone almost like or texture. And so I would especially because I felt like in the book, you know, I would know whether it needed to be funny again, or I would know where I wanted to just kind of do this emotional switch back and have something be really dark. That part was really intuitive, and it felt, I don't know anything about music and I don't do music, but it felt almost musical, like trying to figure out when that would come in and when that would go away. And I was really influenced by, I do read a lot of poetry and a lot of like essays and things like that. And I was kind of influenced by that sense of freedom that I think poets feel about like when you can kind of leap into space. I wanted to feel that in fiction.
Yeah. And I haven't seen what the American cover's like, but the cover in the UK is it's fucking amazing, right?
And it's so good. It's like the best cover ever. I love it so much.
And what I really like is that it feels like a beautiful book. It feels like an object. It feels like, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, digital spaces and people just not paying attention enough. You know, it feels like a thing to absorb. But, do you read stuff on Kindles and e-readers or is it physical for you? Because you know,
I don't read on any kind of device because it just, I mean, I'll read like an article or something, but I don't because I think, you know, books are one of the most portable pleasures. And they're one of the things that, you know, make me the happiest in the world and have since I was very young. And so it's not something I can give up. You know, I feel sort of, also this book, I mean, you've read it. There's a lot of, you know, like there's one whole chapter that just says, so scared, so scared, so scared. And then you can see the SOS. It's almost like a visual poem. And so on a Kindle, I learned from someone who's reading a Kindle that like, it didn't even stay on all on one page. Oh. And that was actually meant to be, I mean, that's meant to be like the part where the book breaks exactly in half. So it, you know, it's just, there's things that I think are harder to do. If it's not on a physical book. So yeah, I wish everyone would. The Granted did such an amazing job. I'll show you the cover for the American. It's pretty. It's nice. It's plain. They tried to give me a girly cover at first, but I raised some hell and I got a plain, kind of gender neutral one. But the what's so great about the one that Granted did is it feels to me like the process of writing the book, like it feels like that's what I was doing. Originally I had these bright colors, more like children's blocks. And I didn't like that part of it, but I love the design. And when they made it, it's funny because you would think it would be more interesting if it had more colors, but I think it's kind of more beautiful just all wood.
Okay, so final question before I let you go. See you in 10 years time. Is the next one gonna take another 10 years, or are you working on something now? You know, obviously don't tell me what it's about, but you know, that's like the death knell for any work in progress. But yeah, how's it going with the next one?
Well, it's about the Bush administration, and it's I'm about a couple years into it. No, it's this one I have to turn in a lot earlier, so we'll see how it goes, but I'm pretty far into it now. And I feel sort of like I found a style that I really like to write in. So I think that it's going to have the same slightly aphoristic quality and be just as fragmentary. And so knowing that I don't have to figure out how to get anyone from A to B and put in the exposition makes me feel like I could probably. Also, I'm teaching a little bit less, and I love to teach, but it takes a lot of time. So I think it gives me more hours to write.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for coming. I am going to try my hardest to put up next week's podcast for you next week. It will be with Akhil Sharma. Peace.